A great Qadi of his time is sent to now plan this whole thing. While he's planning, all those signs were removed. He would plan and think like, next week we will do this, next week we will do this. Slowly, slowly the judges were removed who were Shia. So the judges couldn't make a sound. Statesmen who were Shia were removed. Military might was removed. Slowly, slowly. Because when it's going to be done, this one act, that there is no name of Mahdi, you have to make sure the entire Egypt doesn't go wild. Finally the time comes where it hits the month of Muharram. And Muharram is the world of the Shia. From the 1st till the 10th of Muharram, that's their month. That month it had to fall, that the command was given, now is the time, take out. Which would have been, like you say, the most inappropriate time. But Islam was going to show, when I want to become pure, I will do it in any manner. So the first week, in the khutbah, the name is still kept, but the Qadi just made an extra addition. That he said, in Arabic, so no one would understand, that, O Allah, guide the followers of Mahdi and Adid. So Mahdi and Adid's name was still going to be mentioned, only Allahumma Hadi. That, O Allah, guide them. So those who understood wondered where this came from. And those that never understood, but the name was there. And the following week, Azhar for some reason could not hold the Jummah. Because they knew if it had to happen there, there would have been a war. So that masjid was closed for some preparation, for some restoration, for some need. And in the masjid and every masjid in the lands of Egypt, that name was not mentioned. And it was like the dropping of a bomb. And with so much of worry, Salahuddin al-Ayyubi must have gone through that week. 16 years of effort. But when it dropped, then it was just like silent. And it's mentioned the following week or within the next week, this Al-Adid passed away also. So Salahuddin al-Ayyubi sitting with his Qadi, he says, had I known he was going to pass away, I would have left it for one more week. He died now. So much of stress, so the Qadi laughed and he said, that, O Sultan, had you not taken out his name, you wouldn't have died. He died because of that. That was the death of Shiism in the world. But to understand the gift of Salahuddin al-Ayyubi, ask any student of hadith what you understand of hadith. He will say, names that are in my mind is Fathul Bari, Umdatul Qari, Mullah Ali Qari's Mirqat. Egypt became a land of the ahadith of Rasulullah sallallahu alayhi wasallam. When Salahuddin al-Ayyubi entered Egypt, forget shuruhat of ahadith, there was not the mention of a single hadith. Because every sahabi is a kafir. So there was no ahadith at all in the land. The thanks that goes to bringing Egypt and benefiting the whole Muslim world. So it's written, had this favor of Salahuddin al-Ayyubi not been upon the ummah, Egypt would not have become the center of ilm of ahadith, producing the likes of Hafiz ibn Hajar, Badruddin Aini, Mullah Ali Qari and others. Yet for some strange reason, this gigantic favor of Salahuddin al-Ayyubi hardly ever gets mentioned. I never heard it. You never heard it. As though some shaitani element had the fear that if Muslims were to realize how Salahuddin al-Ayyubi viewed the Shia threat and how he worked tirelessly to rid the ummah of its poison, they would also start despising the Shia, and they themselves would strive to rid the ummah of this poison. Because everyone loves Salahuddin al-Ayyubi. But it's never mentioned what he did. 16 years of his life. Generally, when one speaks of this great giant of Islam, it is only his rescuing of Al-Aqsa from the hands of the crusaders that is discussed. Whereas the efforts of this great man in rescuing Islam from a kufr ideology that was spreading like wildfire amongst innocent Muslims was indeed just as important, if not greater. The grasp of the crusaders over Al-Aqsa was indeed one of the most trying times for the ummah. But it never became a cause of irtidad. Muslims never became murtad. The crusaders never made someone lose their iman. Rather, in the efforts to save the masjid, many believers were blessed with martyrdom. Whereas in the case of the grasp of the Shia over much of the Muslim world, thousands were being robbed of their iman and were being made into eternal fuel for the fire of Jahannam. So that effort of 16 years would be regarded as even more important for Islam than this. But it's not mentioned. So it's something to think about. 16 years of Salahuddin al-Ayyubi was to worry about that inner threat. Thereafter, the next 15 years would be concentrated on getting the Muslim armies. And that is the story of Al-Aqsa, which is a very unique itself. And how he mobilized the armies and how he brought them. And the brink of his success was what we call the Battle of Hittin. And after the Battle of Hittin, it was like the doors of Al-Aqsa opened. So the Battle of Hittin, after it happened, there was one nice letter that really appealed to my mind and heart to understand what was the condition of Islam in that 300 years. That everyone had lost hope. The Shias were throughout and the Crusaders were out. So when the Battle of Hittin was finished, which was the battle against the hugest Crusader army that was ever formed in the Crusades. So when he defeated them, his Qadi, who had been with him in Egypt, he was known as Qadi al-Fadil. Salahuddin al-Ayyubi himself will say that the world will say, I am the conqueror of Egypt. And I brought Islam in Egypt. And I am the conqueror of Al-Aqsa. He says, but it wasn't me, it was Qadi al-Fadil, my ustad. He says, because whatever I did, he told me how to do it. This was a brilliant scholar of his time. But it just happened in the Battle of Hittin, he was not there. So he wrote a letter after that. In the beginning of his letter, he said that there was a time when I was your master. You have now become my master. He said, you are the master of the world. Allah has given you dunya also, you are the king of the world, but he has made you the king of the year after. So after praising him, then he wrote the sentence. He said, your servant is writing this letter when heads have not yet been raised from sajda and tears have not yet been wiped from cheeks, meaning every wali of the time on the destruction of the Christians at Hittin was in sajda. Because this was the coming back of Islam to the lands of Sham. He says, so I'm writing the letter while the other awliya are still in sajda. Their tears are still on their cheeks, but I am now writing. Every time your servant thinks of the churches which shall now be turned back into masajid, and that in the places in which it was said that Allah is the third of three, again we will now hear La ilaha illallah, that Allah is the only one. Why it appealed to me the sentence is because every wali of the time understood that the land of Sham in that period of 100 years was not a Muslim land. There was no masjid which was going to be calling the Adhan. It was a church. It was a system, center of Europe. And for the awliya of the time to see now Islam coming again. So he says, every time the servant thinks about so many masajid which will again become masajid, he renews his thanks to Allah, sometimes verbally, and sometimes from the flow of tears from his eyes. So this was the entire group. Group one, three enemies. There was the Christian world, which everyone knew. And everyone hated. And everyone said, how could you take Al-Aqsa? But the Christians were the in-between. They could never have done what they got without the Shia that came 100 years before them and laid the ground. And they only did what they wanted to do because they were being spurred by another group which was called the hidden force. That three enemies came in, they took over the entire scene, the digging of Al-Aqsa took place, Islam gave them the chance, one command of Almighty Allah came, one man rose up, one slap was given, the Knight Templars disappeared from history, the European Christians were not going to be seen in the lands of Sham. And the Shia threat, the Fatimi Empire, completely collapsed. On the hands of one unique individual of Islam, Islam was going to give an announcement that bring the worst of the worst. I will give them the chance of 100, 150 years. One divine slap will come and everything will go flying. 100 years after Salahuddin Alayyubi would start the what we call the Ottoman Empire, which we spoke about last time that we came, and Islam would just start climbing steps. And when it would reach about 950 years, which we said group one was about 1,000 years, and at 950-960 years was the era of what is called Suleiman the Great, Suleiman Qanuni, the magnificent Suleiman. At that time, Islam was regarded as the strongest force in the entire world. And it had reached that force that it had never reached from the beginning. So Islam was going to say, at the beginning and at the end, it is nothing but Islam. And oh kufr, you will have your chance for a few days within. But the beginning and the end is mine. Group one, we want it. After 1,000 years, one is going to now start group two. That's what we grew in. To understand group two will be much more easier because majority of it we saw. Or we learnt in school history, perhaps we never just joined the puzzle. Group two again had to start with the same. Shaitan would say, first I need the Shia, then I need the European Christian, and the third, I need the digging under Al-Aqsa again. That digging is a unique part of both groups. So important that digging is, that the entire World War I and World War II, which would see the deaths of over 50 million people. If someone has to say, what was the purpose of the entire thing? It will say, to give the small group the chance to dig. She'll wonder, what is it you're digging for? But again, so starting the Shia threat, between the 16th and the 18th century, what we call Iran today, Iran was a land which from A to Z was filled with the most brilliant of the scholars of the Sunnah. It was a land where scholars existed of such a level that the Ottoman Empire would send their students to the land of Iran to become scholars because they did not have the level of ilm that they had. From that level, like how Egypt was chosen in group one to be the Shia, Allah Tabaruk Tala had now given it to Iran. So a man like how Ubaidullah just walked in a land which was full Sunnah. A man called Ismail walks in a land which is full Sunnah, Iran. He is going to be called Ismail the First. Within 10 years, whichever land his army takes over, a historian wrote, and this is a non-Muslim writing, so you can understand how terrible this man must have been. A historian wrote, Ismail was the most successful and intolerant Shia ruler since the fall of the Fatimids. It appears that he aimed for the complete destruction of Sunni Islam, and he largely achieved that goal in the lands over which he ruled. His hatred of the Sunni knew no bounds. His persecution of them was ruthless. What the Fatimids did, he was going to do the same. He required the first three caliphs to be ritually cursed. He abolished the Sunni orders. He seized the properties of the people of the Sunnah. He gave the Sunni ulama a choice, either convert to Shiism or die. Shia scholars were brought in from other regions to take their place. Before the 16th century, there was no Shiism. But just like how the Fatimi Empire came out from nowhere, Iran Shiism also came out of nowhere. And it was going to become stronger and stronger and stronger. Many of our people would think that when Khomeini came, he stopped it. But Khomeini was just to make it even bigger and broader than what it was. This was a group exactly like the Fatimi. During the Fatimi rule, the first group one, tolerance would only be shown to non-Muslims. They would kill the people of the Sunnah. He says, similarly in Iran, the people of the Sunnah were the ones that had to suffer. That is why today in Iran, the people of the Sunnah got no religion. They got no masjid. They got no rights. But as for the Jew in Iran, they are living a very comfortable life. Today, it's no secret. With Google and internet, you just have to go Jews in Iran. And you will see articles and articles of people saying, we live in Tehran. We have mass gatherings. We come in the centers. Our churches, our temples got the Star of David. No one troubles us. When Khomeini took over Iran, one of the verdicts that he passed, he says the Jews in Iran are not the same as the Jews of Israel. Therefore, they will be treated as an integral part of the Islamic Republic. He could never say that for the Sunni Muslims of Iran. It was only for the Jew. It was for this reason that when Maulana Manzoor Nu'mani wrote that he heard Khomeini saying, I want unity in the Ummah. But there was no way that he showed that he wanted unity. So he wrote this. He says, when a few years back, Ayatullah Ruhullah Khomeini gave the call for an Islamic revolution and set up the so-called Islamic revolution, it was well expected that in order to make his call popular, he would not reopen the pages of bitter history and continuous disputes and controversies between the Sunni and the Shia, meaning what started after the 16th century and how they hated the Khalifs. And the way Khomeini said, I want unity. So if you wanted unity, don't mention those points. Just carry on ruling as a Shia, but don't bring about that stories. In fact, it was expected from such a strong leader that he would have in fact told the people of Iran, as long as we continue saying that the Sahaba were Shia and they were the worst, then how are we going to give dawah to the non-Muslim? Because when the non-Muslim will ask us, what is the proof of your Islam? And they will say that the first group who lived around Muhammad sallallahu alaihi wasallam, if they themselves did not believe in him really, what do you expect of people who are coming after so many years? So Khomeini would have supposed to have told that to open up the doors of dawah to the non-Muslims, let's just cover these pages. He says it was hoped that Khomeini, in order to establish the authority of Islam, when it was needed so much, would choose to forget the past Shia beliefs and to begin a new chapter which would show the beautiful picture of Islam so that it could serve as a great dawah to non-Muslims from around the world. Unfortunately, the very opposite occurred. Hundreds of writings, books, pamphlets were soon being spread in which Khomeini himself expressed the old Shia beliefs. In his book Al-Hukumatul Islamiyah, he had expressed the view that the Shia Imams are divine, that they occupy a rank higher than that of the Anbiya, meaning what Ubaidullah had said, I can make haram halal, we can also make haram and halal, and that the whole world is under their command and authority. This was Khomeini writing. No Muslim in his life would ever think a Muslim could ever write this. Likewise, in his Persian book Kashful Ashrar, he has not only criticized and condemned the Sahaba, particularly Abu Bakr, Umar and Usman radiallahu anh, but has used such language that can only be used for a gang of wicked men, evildoers, conspirators and sinners. These perverted assertions and beliefs go side to side with his call. These are mentioned not in secret instructions or private letters, but are contained in published books and journals. So what the crux of this whole thing is, just as how the Fatimi Empire was needed for the Crusaders to do what they did, similarly the Shia was needed for what was going to happen after that to happen. Once the Shia was done, then Shaitan would give the go-ahead that now the Christian European source must come about. Now there was no church in the world. After 1,000 years, the churches of Europe had died. Now it was called the secular Europe. It was called the state. In the states, different states were coming up. But the strongest of them, which was in the front line of Shaitan, was going to be Great Britain. Great Britain was going to become so strong, that one quarter of the entire world was going to be theirs. They would rise now, because Islam now had said, we'll give you your in-between time. You can make yourself the most strongest and strongest. How at that time European church was so strong and they took over the entire lands of Sham. Now Great Britain was going to do the same thing. So it was going to lead to a stage. Great Britain would understand that for them to get what they needed, and what they needed, the land of Al-Aqsa. And why Al-Aqsa? So that digging can take place. For them to get that, there was one thing that was necessary, that as long as the Khalifa was still existing, the land of Al-Aqsa would never be taken over. And very fast I will go through this so at least me and you and your children can understand how history then went and who was used to bring us to the position that we are now today. At that point, the Khilafat, the Ottoman Empire was now weak because it was round two. And every round you have your up and down. The Ottoman Khilafat was weak. It was called the weak man of Europe. Great Britain was strong. European powers were strong. But still they were not ready to hit the lands of Al-Aqsa. The Ottoman Empire was in debt. At that time, Great Britain now needs that inner support. The Shia is there, but they need even more. So what will happen? My friend wrote a book. So I asked him permission to take part of the book. The book is not yet published. It's regarding the lands of Turkey. But in that he wrote a few paragraphs which really appeal to me, and I will go and read this practically word to word. Just to understand that how this happened. As Christian France had once been used to orchestrate the movement of the Crusades in order for satanic forces to get open access to the lands of Al-Aqsa, now Great Britain was to be employed for that very purpose. First to be done was weakening of the Khilafah. World War I began in 1332 after Hijri. So unique it was, just like how there it started 300 years after Hijri, when the Shia started. Here in the next one it was going to be again from 1000, we come to 13, 300 years down the line, but group 2 as we mentioned, it's most likely 500 years. So 300 years down the line, World War I. Prior to this, the Usmani Khalifa still existed, but it was an extremely weak and fragile Khilafat. It was referred to as the sick man of Europe. Ottoman sultans were trying to revive it, but it was too hard against the strength of Europe. Sultan Abdul Hamid was a very pious man. He was dealing wisely with the Russian, the French, the British and the Austrians. He understood everyone wanted to jump. He had built the Hijaz Railway. He had established an Islamic university in China. And he was totally opposing the Zionist idea of land in Israel. And loudly he was telling the people of Turkey that there is a group in the land Turkey called the Young Turks. I don't trust them. They haven't learned in our lands. They have been brought up in Britain. You cannot allow them into the politics. But because these Young Turks were so strong. So the Young Turks, they made a deal with Germany, which was known as the secret deal, that if Germany has to ever go to war, then we will join you in war. And when World War I took place, which had nothing to do with the Muslim Ummah, but because of the secret deal of this group called the Young Turks, of whom Mustafa Kemal was then going to be the leader, the entire Muslim world was pulled into a war which it knew nothing about. So World War I started. But before the war could start, because they understood even with the war, the Ottoman Empire somehow will fight the whole world. So what they had to do, the British used a multi-pronged approach to destroy the Khalifa. First they went to the Arabs, and they explained to them the issue of Arab nationalism. That you, an Arab, a Turk, cannot rule over you. You must rule over yourself. For this year, universities were opened up in the lands of Syria, Jordan, Lebanon and Palestine. Nationalism was taught in their schools. And two people in the lands of Hijaz were brought. One was going to be called Sharif Hussein, what we normally know then became the kings of Jordan and other lands. Saddam Hussein, they were all part of that Hussein family. And the other one was Abdul Aziz Saud. And because of him, we understand Saudi Arabia. Sharif Hussein was in charge working under the Ottomans. Abdul Aziz Saud was a leader of a small tribe. He had no part in politics at all. Two people were brought in by the British. Both of them were promised that if you will rebel against the Ottoman, then we will allow you to establish your own Arab rule over the lands of the Arabs. We will give it all to you. That deal was signed, and at the same time Britain is signing another deal with France. That when this war is over, the lands of the Arab, we will divide it between me and you. I will take so much and you will take so much. Abdul Aziz and Sharif Hussein, they can go running to whoever they want to run. But Abdul Aziz and Sharif Hussein now were going to rebel. Because of the rebellion, Mawlana Hussein Ahmad Madani rahimullah most likely wrote, or somebody else wrote, that when the war took place, World War I, the Ottoman Empire, despite being so weak, fighting on so many different fronts, was still successful in keeping out the threat. It was only because of the Arab rebellion that in the ending it collapsed. Had that not been there, the Muslim, which was so weak at that time, would have also destroyed the entire Europe. But when this war took place, having fallen for the trick of the British, the Sharif attacked the Turks, taking over lands which were under the Usmani Khilafah, such as Makkah, Jeddah, Amman, Damascus. The Usmani Khilafah was forced into World War I on the side of Germany because of the young Turks who entered into a secret agreement with the Germans. The Sultan was left with no choice but to declare jihad against the Allied forces. The Khilafah was stretched due to fighting on many fronts, the Caucasus, the Dardanelles, Palestine, Iraq, Izmir, Antalya, Romania, Hijaz. This allowed the British and its allies to invade Muslim lands. Iraq was lost in 1333, Baghdad and Palestine in 1335, Damascus and Istanbul in 1336. In this way, every capital of Islam was taken by the Allied forces. This is exactly like Group 1 when we said when they entered Sham, in that period of 50 years, they took over the entire lands of Sham. To see them taking over at that time brought the same tears like the first time. The only thing is this time they never established churches because they understood it won't work. The first time they put up churches in the lands of Sham. When they saw it never worked, the second time what they were going to do? They were going to leave the masjid as masjids. But the only thing is the imams of the masjid and the leader of the country was going to be their people. So we will leave you thinking you are a Muslim as long as your leaders will do what we want them to do. So every masjid would become a secular masjid. Every madrasa would become a secular school. And every leader will be called a puppet leader. No church was going to come in these lands now. But no land was going to have Islam. In Group 1, the Christians had to outlaw Islam, which wasn't easy. In Group 2, it was the Muslim. Mustafa Kemal in Turkey was going to say that I want nothing with Islam at all. So much hatred he had for Islam that the Turkish language, which had a lot of Arabic words in it, even for that they had an entire force created that you will go through the language and any word that originated from Arabic also, we will take it out of the dictionary and bring another word in it. It was called Istanbul, the city of Islam. He couldn't stand the word Islam. It had to be Istanbul. And previously we mentioned, but the same was going to happen. Turkey was then going to be the example for Iraq and for Egypt and for Syria and for Jordan. And the entire land was going to become worse than what it was even in Group 1. In Group 1 there was churches, but Muslims remained on Islam. In Group 2, Muslims were going to be made open murtad.